to Indra status to Indra Gopa germ status, and then has to come all the way back up. So it's a very long and very happy and very pleasing life, but at the end, one has to experience rebirth. And that is very unhappy, very painful, very difficult way to have to live. So, of course, if one is very fortunate and gets blessed by the Supreme Lord, like Manu, then there can be reinstatement in the spiritual sky. But this is exceptional. The Lord doesn't give His benedictions out so easily. So one of the lessons in this purport is that one can begin worship of the Supreme Lord even that there are material desires within. One devotee was asking Prabhupada, so, but I speak to people, I preach to them all the time, and they're not interested in Krishna consciousness, so what can I do? And Prabhupada's answer was, so if they were interested in Krishna consciousness, there'd be no need to preach to them, would there? So everybody has, and it was kind of got a chuckle out of everybody. Now, what's the use of your preaching? You go out and preach, you'd be preaching to people who don't have any knowledge about Krishna consciousness. So everybody has material desires. Akama moksha kama va. Everybody is filled. And therefore that verse says that whether you have no desire, you're full of material desires. It doesn't matter. You're going to have so many material desires, but even for whatever it is you want, you have to worship the Supreme Lord. So even those people who come to worship Lord Venkateshwar, Lord Balaji, and Tirupati, they may be wanting some material things, but they're getting purified by worshiping in a place where many saints come. They're worshiping a place where the Supreme Personality of Godhead, self-manifesting deity, is there. So they're actually getting benefit. Now, Prabhupada talks about liberation, about how everyone wants liberation. But generally, people don't know what liberation means. Liberation, generally, now, I think Prabhupada or someone was talking about it, they means kind of a economic or political liberation. People think that if they get a higher status in their income, they get a higher salary. Or if their social status is somehow the caste system or the female and male system, or you know, somehow or other that's transcended, and then a person could feel, oh, I'm liberated now because I'm politically in a different situation or I'm socially in a different situation, I'm liberated. But that cheapening of what we mean by liberation, and even in spiritual circles, people talk about being liberated, but they really don't know what liberation is. Most of them think liberation means to think that the world is unreal. Brahma, Satya, Jagamita, everything is false. That's kind of a Buddhist concept. Or that at the end of life, the perfection will be, liberation will be that I'll just lose my identity. I won't have any pains and pleasures, and I'll merge into oneness. That's liberation. So that kind of general concept of liberation was even, of moksha, was prevalent in the Sanskrit language when people talked about moksha or mukti. They just thought liberation means somehow to understand that I'm a spirit. And they didn't have to go any further than that. They didn't have to know what that spirit had to do. So it was Madhvacharya who helped establish what liberation actually meant. And that was in the 13th century. And he is one of the leaders in our sampradaya. Of course, we call our sampradaya Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya. That liberation means to be firmly fixed at the lotus feet of the Personality of Godhead. And worshipping Radha and Krishna in that way. His philosophy was almost oneness and difference. It was called technically differentiated oneness, where he recognized living entities and Krishna as and material nature as three separate kind of conditions. But nonetheless, he established that liberation means worshipping the Personality of God in a personal relationship, sambandha, that we have an identity, the Supreme Lord has an identity, and we can carry on our worship. But that is actually the meaning of liberation. So it's very common everywhere that people think of getting perfection in life, either as going to heaven, and there's a church, I won't mention what the denomination is, but it shows what heaven is like. At least there was a film that they used to show people. And heaven was in a coffee shop. And the the boys and girls and mother and father were sitting there drinking coffee, and then they would see grandfather and auntie and uncle coming. Oh, come on, sit down, enjoy. That was heaven. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to be there with all your friends and relatives drinking coffee in a nice coffee shop. And that you do forever. That's eternal happiness. Anyway, that's one concept of liberation that one of the major denominations in this country sort of pushes as, you know, holds up that this is the movie that you can see, you can get liberated. So liberation is not an ordinary thing. It means getting a spiritual body. It means the dissolving of our material body, and it means the merging of our spiritual, of our subtle body and our spiritual body, in which we remember all of our past lives, in which we see every living entity as part and parcel of Krishna, equally adorable and equally a part of our family. So it's also mentioned that by being very charitable, being very magnanimous, one can get the benedictions of the Lord. That's actually one of the qualities of a Brahman Prati. What is it? Gati Pratigrahi, Yagyan Yagyan, Yajan Yajan, Patan Patan, Dani Pratigrahi. One is meant to receive and give in charity. And when this charity is performed on behalf of the Supreme Lord, like our guests who bring tons and tons over the years of chapati flour and various other things, vegetables, but they're giving it to Krishna. That kind of charity is in the mode of goodness or in Shuddha Sattva. And that leads one to ultimate perfect liberation, not just liberation to be in a heavenly planet, but to gain the lotus feet of Radha and Krishna. When I first went to London as a missionary, for lack of a better word, we noticed that many of the people we preached to had different gods and goddesses in their homes. And one place that was very popular looked like a menagerie. I think there was a play, wasn't there, called The Glass Menagerie? And remember that? And this place had dozens, literally dozens of different Lakshmis and Ganeshas and Shivas and Indras. It was just Agnis, just amazing. I mean, you have to ask who they were. And at one time, this was one of the most popular, it isn't anymore, now Bhaktivedanta Manor, but this was one of the most popular temples in all of London, in that part of London. So everyone had their kind of little deity that they came into worship, and that was considered very ecumenical, very, very open, that we can come and worship anything. So Prabhupada is talking about the problem of this, and how, you know, if one worships in the right way, one can get the mercy of Krishna. And then there's that verse, what is it? Suchinam Srimatam Gehe Yoga Vrasta Parayate, that one, if one doesn't complete the task, one gets a birth, which enables one to further prosecute Krishna consciousness in a family of yogis, just like we've seen these children. They're exhibiting qualities very early in life of singing, dancing, clapping their hands, looking at the deity, because they're born in a family of devotees. So that opportunity is there, and for everyone who's a devotee. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur said we shouldn't care if we get into a spiritual body. Of course, we really want to, but if we can, we should just pray to the Lord that somehow I can be born in the family of a devotee, or even be above an insect in the home of a devotee. That way, I'll be saved. I'll get a better opportunity. Prabhupada mentions an Ananyabhak in the Bhagavad Gita. Says it's expressed as Ananyabhak. And what does that mean? That which is impossible to obtain from any other source. And in another place where that word is used in the 10th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Tatenu Kampam Susumikshamano, Bunjana Evatma Krita Vipakam, that Ananyabhak is mentioned there, Jiveta Yomukti Pade Sadayabhak. I guess that's Ananyabhak, Dayabhak, Prabhupada uses interchangeably. In Dayabhak, it's used to mean the rightful heir. In other words, a rightful heir can obtain something which is not ordinarily achievable by anyone else, because that person has the rightful heir to the kingdom, the throne, the treasury, whatever it may be. And according to that verse, one who offers obeisances to the Lord, even accepting all the past actions of one's past deeds, and continually offers obeisances, despite all the adversities that may come upon one, with mind, body, and words offers obeisances, that person, it is said, is eligible for liberation. as we've been discussing what liberation is, because it becomes the rightful claim. So that rightful claim is there for everyone who enters the process of surrendering to the Supreme Lord. The surrendering process is also very abhorrent to people in this material world. To surrender to anyone is very frightening. To give up, there's that symbol of surrender where both hands are raised, and you see two Uzis pointing in the person's back. That's the symbol of surrender, both hands up. Once I was driving from San Diego to LA, and the border police are there, and the car in front of us somehow had what they thought were illegal aliens. So all of a sudden, a group, this horde, it seemed like, of police from the border police, the federal police, descended on this car with their guns pointed. Everyone had to have their hands up. And we knew that was it, you know, it was over. So Draupadi also, she was trying to protect herself when the crews were ripping her saris off one after the other. And at one point, she just said, "I give up." And she raised her both hands in that gesture of surrender. "But I can't save myself, I can't protect myself. Only Krishna." She was raising her hands to the Supreme Lord. So that gesture is not only a gesture of giving up, but it's a gesture of reaching up to the Supreme Lord for help, because we can't really get help ourselves. So this surrendering process is a very difficult one, but it is the process by which one can become the rightful heir to Krishna's goodness, to Krishna's opulence, to Krishna's majesty, or whatever Krishna's love, whatever we want to get from Krishna. We have to undergo this process of surrender. Surrender means giving up everything. When you're surrendering to the opposite military commanders, it means you're at their mercy. They can kill you, they can put you in prison, they can let you go, but you're at their mercy. So Prabhupada quotes the last verse of the Shikshastakam, Shlishava Pararatam Vinashtumam, that whatever you do, whether you crush me, whether you embrace me, I'm your surrendered soul or slave, or he uses a lot of different words like that. But what it really means to surrender is to give up our material concepts of enjoyment. And that is very difficult. But Krishna also says, Mameva ye prapadyante, prapadyante means surrender. That it is only by this act of surrender that we can overcome material nature, which is duratiya, which is very, very difficult to overcome. So difficult that there is no other way. Duravapam is the word, difficult to achieve, used in this verse. Duravapam, very, very difficult to achieve. So that to do the thing that is most difficult, to achieve the thing that is most difficult, is possible by doing another thing that is either as difficult or more difficult, and that's the process of surrender, giving up our concepts of what enjoyment is, who I am. Prabhupada glorified Sanatana Goswami because he's, although very, very learned and considered a pundit, his very first question was, "I don't know who I am, where I am, where I'm going, what I'm doing. Please tell me." So, huh? Kayami, those are his first words in Bengali to the Lord. So he's praised. What kind of a pundit? Pundit generally means someone who's vastly learned. And the Brahmins were supposed to embody punditism. They're supposed to be. And still, it's an English word too, isn't it? Pundit. Pundit means someone who's very learned, has mastered a certain subject. So his opening words were words of surrender. "I don't know anything. I'm glorified for knowing all these languages, knowing so many different branches of knowledge, and yet I really don't even know who I am. I don't know anything at all. So please enlighten me." Those were his opening words. That's a symptom of surrender, that someone can give up all one's preconceptions, all of one's knowledge, all of one's forms of enjoyment and surrender. So, I want to talk a little bit more about sadhana, since it's on the upswing and improving. And this is a topic that needs to be brought up again and again, because we need to remind ourselves how important it is. We were talking the other day about how Krishna consciousness devotional service runs on two tracks, the track of spiritual and personal enlightenment, getting deeper and deeper into the shastras, diving and surfacing, and the Vedas. We were reading a verse the other day where Prabhupada talks about what we should take shelter of one who bathes in the Vedas. We should be into that concept of bathing. And the other track is preaching, taking that knowledge outside of ourselves and being very merciful and benedictory towards others, giving them the advantage of preaching Krishna consciousness. So as we're leading up to Prabhupada's centennial and reading about what Prabhupada did when he was here, as we will be hearing about what his vision was for Potomac, we will see that Prabhupada not only wanted the deities to be absolutely gorgeous and irresistible, attractive from every point of view, and the grounds here to be extremely attractive, such that the neighbors and everyone else in the whole Washington area would remember it, would become famous for its beauty and its renunciation and spiritual environment. But he also wanted some very extraordinary things to happen in terms of preaching. For example, he asked Ambarish to build a museum here. No small thing. Build a museum in Washington. Every site we looked at in the center of Washington was in excess of 15 or 20 million, just to look at it. But nevertheless, he's made a commitment to help fulfill Prabhupada's desire. And probably he's going to do it because he's very determined to do it. So this is just one of the things. This was Prabhupada's probably most ambitious thing. Ambarish probably still talks about how he has to fulfill that. So this is one thing. Another is the kind of standard of making a preaching center very wonderful, and that is that the devotees that live in that center, apart from becoming very saintly and purified, they regularly go out and speak about Krishna consciousness and try to induce the conditioned souls to take part. So I have a Sankirtan party that goes out, not as often as we want. We'll get more devotees, but we do, and we distribute lots and lots of leaflets and lots of prasadam. And we've had many people come here as a result of getting these pamphlets and getting this prasadam and talking to devotees. Dozens of people, and many letters, isn't it so, who have written in. Dozens of people have written in. So they're becoming more and more aware of us. In Georgetown, and Adams Morgan, and DuPont Circle, and various parts of Washington, more and more aware. And as time goes on, that will only increase. We have our home programs. It's incumbent on everyone to do some form of outreach, some indweller of the Dham. So we go out almost every night of the week. We go into people's homes. We convince them. We try to convince them to make their home into a temple, to be more Krishna conscious, to chant more, to ultimately take initiation. And we have our distribution of books, which is also one of the most lively, life-giving aspects of Krishna consciousness, a Krishna conscious center, a temple, where we see the things that convinced us all, more than anything else, to join Krishna consciousness. That is the books that contain the teachings of Srila Prabhupada, going out and reaching dozens and dozens of people every day. So that's also another form of preaching. So there are many, many different forms of preaching and development. Prasadam distribution, which Priyavrata is embodying, as he apparently is just playing with keys, sometimes behind a computer. He's got a website that goes all over the world now. And it's really quite amazing how many people. What's the number of people who log on to an internet site now? It's in the 1,000 a week. A month. Get your site. So 1,000 people. 1,000 people. Just imagine that every month you're seeing his website. And this is a process of constant development. It's not you make a website and then it's 1,000 people. Every day you have to keep doing something, make it more attractive. Figure out a way to get people to donate. Figure out a way to get people to stay on and look at it more and go deeper into it. So that's just one aspect of outreach, of prasadam.
If I do a search for vegetarian charities, we're number one, but it's not 6 million search engines.
Number one on the list of vegetarian charities. Vegetarian charity.
You know, like number one, number three, number five, number four, like the top ten, top ten.
Where's that in? We're number one.
Well, it's like a list of 10 pages, and we'll be like 4 of those 10 pages.
Yeah, if you search under vegetarian charities, which more and more people are doing, you come up with Food for Life, that's number one.
Who puts it on the top?
What was that? You got an award, didn't you, for your site? What was it from?
It's online service voted as a hot site.
It's known as a hot site on online services. So, since we had a recent marriage,
site to visit.
And some of us are in the married category. I want to say something about what Prabhupada said about marriage. Ami Vedna, this means you. I was talking about the marriage. Now this is something that sometimes people ask me, well, Maharaj, you think I should get married? I mean, you know, I'm getting kind of an old brahmachari now, and I'm 28 years old, or I'm 53, should I get married? They ask sannyasis these questions. Sometimes we call it the orange man's burden. It was the white man's burden. Anyway, what Prabhupada said I thought was really very interesting, because he said, if you want to get married, be like Bhakti Vinod, you can have dozens of children. He gave so many reasons. He said, but if you get married, your devotional service should double, should not be cut in half. So I thought that was very interesting, that, yeah, if you're going to have a partner, then you should do twice as much, right? And it all makes sense. And if you're not, you're going to do twice as much, you'll probably only do half as much, because you'll get kind of in the slump, you know. You'll become, I don't know, what do they call them, couch potatoes or something? Yeah, well, that's what people that watch TV. That's it. But I mean, you know, the tendency, inertia kind of pulls us. So that's what Prabhupada said. Anyway, I thought it was very interesting. So, again, it's incumbent on all of us, as being a base for preaching, that we're very strong. And as I was mentioning before, the strength is shown by our commitment. What is our commitment? Our commitment is to that. Be there for class, be there for the greeting, be there for Guru Puja, be there for Mangal Arati, and so on. So it creates a kind of unity. And if we don't do it, it creates a disunity. If we don't, then there's the do's, the people that do, the people that don't. And we don't have the kind of community spirit we're striving for. So we just have to, now we've started, we're on a roll, as they say, and everyone will get stronger if we encourage one another. It can't only be me all the time. I mean, I'll keep doing it, but I'm sure people probably will be sick of me. But if we encourage each other, that's what really makes for spiritual relationships. And ultimately, the dati pradigranati, guyamakarti pichati, we become more inclined to reveal ourselves, reveal our minds, what we're all about, to devotees. Because we understand from our readings that devotees are the most important people in the world, that associating with devotees is the most important people in the world. And what are we supposed to do with devotees? We're supposed to make friends with them, according to the famous verse, Bali Sheshu Dvisha Sucha. Maitra Pramekha Popiksha. That's what a Majjhima Adhikari does. Yeah, that's right. Shake hands. and Lord Kapila also says the same thing, that you know, we're friends with the, we're worshiping the Supreme Lord, we're preaching to the innocent, we're friends with devotees, and we're avoiding the envious. Lord Kapila says that. The Nabi Yogendra says that to King Nimi. And it's throughout. It's the verse Prabhupada quotes a lot of times. So how do we deepen that relationship? We deepen it by doing service together. And we do service together by starting the day together, by worshiping together, by being one in Krishna's family together, like we're all a part of that family. So that's what we're agreeing to do. And we need to continue to be stronger and stronger. It's, as I was saying the other day, it's the difference between being weak and being strong. It's a test of our determination. I mean, anyone can go out and preach because it's fun. Anyone can go out and do just about anything for Krishna, because it's fun. Actually, it's very enjoyable. Even the things that would you know, seem to be drudgery for a lot of people, when you do it for Krishna, it's actually fun. It becomes fun. But what's not fun is getting up early in the morning. That is very painful. Especially, I don't know, how about you, but for me, the first 10 seconds, it's excruciating, and then the next 10 seconds, it's just not very excruciating, just plain excruciating. And then for the next 10 seconds, it hurts. And then, you know, after about 5 or 10 minutes, the pain sort of wears off. But that's a test of our determination. And everything in spiritual life is kind of like that. You know, with everything we get that we enjoy, we've undergone a little bit of austerity somewhere. And just like these long-distance runners, you know, they work out every day, day after day. And what are they doing? They're pushing back the threshold of pain, so they can run in the Olympics and get an award. So in a, that's a kind of perverted, you might say, sense of what we do in spiritual life. We try to undergo austerities so that they're not austerities. The runner runs for 440 and that hurts, but after a few weeks or a few months, then it's no problem. He can run 2 laps, then he can run 3 laps and 4 laps. So the more we make it a habit, and a good habit it is, the less painful it becomes. It just becomes part of life. So that's when the commitment becomes real, and the austerity no longer is an austerity. Then we're on to the next austerity, whatever that may be. But the hurdle of being present in the morning for a temple indweller is very, very important, and a habit that we need to develop and strengthen ourselves. Yes?
From the purport of this verse, you touched on this very briefly, but from the purport of this verse, comparing to what we've read of Christ's sorry recollections of prophet statements and those here, one could see that we appear to have extremely contradictory messages, almost like a schizophrenic message. On the one hand, you know, mother, women, you know, the family, you know, tiger sucking blood, demoness, you know, there's heavy condemnations of family, which is kind of like the epitome of material happiness. And then today's verse, one of these rather rare verses that you don't hear devotees talk about a lot, it seems to imply it's fine to be materially happy. You can completely enjoy material happiness. There's other verses about Swami Buddha too, when he gave his daughter away, you know, about how he was, he completely enjoyed material life to the fullest. And then he also, you know, went back to God, you know, became liberation, I think he went back to God.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems our society, to a certain extent, has reflected that contradiction or misunderstanding for years, and that even within the movement, it's kind of like material life is absolutely condemned. Don't even look, spit at the thought of any kind of sense gratification. It's all in my spit. Watch out. And then there's these other verses. And like as we grow, you know, there's a lot of discussion of what that growth means. It seems it's going more towards the congregational sense. What's our message?
Yeah. The first message is to be spiritual, to put Krishna in the center of life. Then varnashram, family life, and all of the social conventions that we see around us can become normalized and happy. The message is that because Krishna has been removed, and Prabhupada said this about India, people, some of us go, why is India such a spiritual country? There's so many earthquakes, 5,000 people died in Mathura, and this and that happens. And he said, because they've forgotten Krishna. That, because Krishna has the original sense of who Krishna really is, that has been removed. And because that's not existing in our society around us, we find that things aren't so happy. I mean, the family, the job, the recreation, those things are not satisfying to people because there's no Krishna there. But a family can be happy. Recreation can be happy. The job can even be happy. The hobbies, they can be happy if Krishna is there in the center. So sometimes the term varnashram is used to say to within our society that unless we do varnashram straight away, unless everyone immediately identifies themselves at, you know, one of the eight orders or levels, spiritual levels, or one of the four orders, or you know, really has to identify, I'm a Brahmin, and I'm going to do this kind of work for the rest of my life, from early childhood, or I'm a Kshatriya. Well, this is called Varnashram, but Daivi Varnashram is the Varnashram in which Krishna is at the center. And Prabhupada makes a very clear distinction between those two. If there is Krishna at the center, then it makes sense to understand what your service is. If Krishna's not there, then it makes no sense at all. So, when there is an appeal to improve the condition, the social condition in ISKCON, of family life, or of brahmacharis, or of groups of people who band together because they work and they can benefit from each other by consolidating certain energies, certain activities, we're talking about Krishna being in the center of all those things. So, for example, I know that myself, sometimes when I'm visiting households and speaking about Krishna consciousness, I can tell people are a little afraid because here's a guy who doesn't have any money, he doesn't have anything, he doesn't own anything, he doesn't have a bank account, he's wearing sapphire, he's never going to get married. That frightens people. And some people, just it's just too much to have that kind of preaching. But if a couple goes into their home, they can see, oh yes, you can have a job, you can have a bank account, you can have a car, you can have health insurance, you can have children, you can have them educated in school, you can do, you can drive, you can have community service, you can render some help other charities, etc., etc. Then they're not frightened, they're not afraid. And this is what we mean when we say social development in the Hare Krishna movement. Prabhupada wanted this. He wanted a temple in every home. He wanted a deity in every house. He wanted every householder to convince myriad other householders to be like them. And the example was Kurma Brahman, and he wanted to go with Lord Chaitanya, who renounced. He said, no, you bring your friends, you bring your family to your home every day and preach. And Prabhupada gave that example.